Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 159 of The Bugle, the audio newspaper which a recent computer simulation suggests would have been listened to by the following dead celebrities: ace German jingle writer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Admittedly, some of his jingles were pretty long. He couldn't have really got away with it in today's more urgent advertising world. A three-hour opera to advertise sofas might have been fired in 1790, but not today. Così fan tutte, comfortable for everyone. Not say Di Figaro, the finest nut and fig pies money can buy.
Oh dear.
Thanks very much. Also, would have dead celebrities who'd listened to The Bugle, professional king and celebrity executionee, Louis XVI of France, massive celeb in his day, the late 18th century French Beyoncé of having your head chopped off. Also, turn of the first millennium stand-up parabolist, semi-pro donkey racer and convicted felon, Jesus Christ, and the Babylonian gardening hater, King Nebuchadnezzar II, credited, of course, with the creation of the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He was, in fact, the first man ever to try, convict, and execute a garden. Did want to bump him off in an electric chair, but it hadn't been invented, so he had to hang the guilty garden instead. He left the dead gardens hanging in public as a warning to other gardens, but unfortunately for him, people flocked to see them and said, "Oh, Nebo, I love what you've done with your lobelias," and the whole thing kind of took off. He had to pretend that he meant to do it. Anyway, after that starts, let's get into the podcast. I'm Andy Zaltzman, live in London, England, and joining me from New York, what is it, bigger than a town, smaller than a universe, city, that's it. It's a man who's had more hot dinners than you've had hot dinners, if you're a bit younger than him, or have lived your entire life in a drought-stricken region, or an igloo. It's John Oliver!
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy, I talk to you from my home in New York, rather than a studio. We were having to call a little late this week, because on Friday I had to go to Chicago to go and interview Captain Jim Lovell, the astronaut who was the first man to fly around the moon on Apollo 8, and was also famously played by Tom Hanks in Apollo 13, the film about the little space snafu that nearly killed him. And it was pretty humbling, Andy, to be sitting opposite an 83-year-old man who has been in space four times, and then trying to do stupid jokes with him. He was remarkably tolerant, considering the fact that at any point you could have said, "Oh, here's an idea. Hands up, anyone in this room who's been to the moon." Oh, is it just me? Oh, okay. I guess it's time for everyone else to shut the f*** up, then.
Do you not see this? I mean, how many times did he actually tread on the moon, John?
Well, he was supposed to tread on the moon during Apollo 13,
right.
And then the mission changed to attempting not to die.
Right.
So that's still a little bit of a sore point with Captain Lovell.
Swing and a miss.
It was a whiff. But I guess in terms of, you know, not dying at the end of it and saving his and his crewmates' lives, I guess you're probably getting on base. It's just not a home run. Talking of which, Andy,
what?
Last week I went to Kansas City to take part in a big charity event for the Children's Mercy Hospital there, which is a fantastic hospital that never turns anyone away despite the ludicrousness of the American healthcare system. I got to play air hockey against some of the fantastic kids on the cancer ward there, and initially was letting them win before actually being legitimately beaten by them. But the focus of the event was a poker tournament, which, you know, I flamed out in pretty quickly. But the highlight for me was a charity wiffle ball game that was set up before the Kansas City Royals Chicago Cubs match that night. And there was a decent-sized crowd there to watch it. I was on a team with, among others, Rob Riggle, Matt Cassel, the quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs, and Hall of Fame Royals legend George Brett. And we were playing against a team featuring other ex-baseball players, as well as Paul Rudd, John Hamm, and Dermot Mulroney. Everyone was allowed to pick their own number, so I told Riggle that I wanted 1774, explaining that that was the last truly great year in American history, expecting him to take that as a joke, Andy, and not expected to turn up to the stadium with that number actually on the back of my shirt. So I think I instantly managed to endear myself to the proud Midwestern crowd straight away. And it was only a very quick three-inning game. And when it came to be my turn to bat, I have to say, I did suddenly feel very nervous, especially as Matt Cassel had just melted the ball into the catering area to put us up 2-0. Paul Rudd was pitching, Andy. The ball came in. My first swing, I swung as hard as I could, and I'm not kidding, I smashed it over the left field fence for a home run. I couldn't believe it. I can't even remember much about running around the bases, apart from deciding to moonwalk from third base to home plate. Where I was met by Matt Castle and George Brett going crazy and Riggle laughing his arse off. And then George Brett, Andy, Hall of Fame baseball legend George Brett, was screaming at me, where the f*** did you learn to swing like that? And this, Andy, this is the key point. This is where I suddenly learned that there is a tangible skill in athletes delivering boring interviews. Because the announcer shoved the microphone into my face at home plate and asked me how I felt. And for some reason, I chose to say, it's really not that difficult at sport. Thus managing to completely obliterate all the goodwill that I'd built up over the previous 45 seconds.
I find that almost impossible to leave, John, because I've seen you play tennis. I've also seen you attempt cricket in a cricket net. And I would not have believed that your central nervous system had it in itself to hit a baseball anywhere, let alone over a fence.
I know. I guess it was just panic. There's an amazing photo online. I'll send it to you of me crossing home plate, high-fiving people. And I think it might be my greatest ever sporting moment, Andy, in a depressingly short list.
So, Jim Lovell, did you ask him whether or not presumably the purpose of the mission was to try and rescue the Soviet dog that had been sent up before them.
That's right, he's an animal lover, yeah. And he was going up on behalf of the RSPCA. Shame on you, Russia. I'll bring that dog back for you. Here, boy.
Does he count as an astronaut if he's not actually still in space as well?
That's a good point, and that's a challenging question that I guess... You know, that probably seems like a funny thing to ask them until you're sitting right in front of them.
Did you suggest that he go straight back where he came from, out of space, and that he's not welcome here?
Yeah, that's right.
Like
America, love it or leave it, Jim Lovell. Stop stringing America along. You either live here or you don't.
So this is Bugle 159 for the week beginning Monday, the 4th of July, 2011. 4th of July, of course, means only one thing. To our American listeners, one of the key dates in any American year, a date when Americans the world over pause to think of great achievements past, of feats of bravery and daring. That's right. It's the former racing driver René Arnoux's birthday. And on the undercard to Arnoux's 63rd American Independence Day, they when Americans assert their independence by locking their children in their houses, tying their pets to a lamppost and putting their elderly relatives into a controlled coma whilst they go out unencumbered by responsibility and jump around on a bouncy castle. As always, a section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin this week. There is how-to guides, including how to fake your own death, how to fake someone else's death, how to fake your own birth, and how to make people believe you are alive and well when you are in fact dead. And in a new series, we are chronicling every single UN Security Council resolution ever passed, beginning with a commemorative supplement on Resolution 1, Biscuits at Security Council Meetings.
Top story this week, sale of the century, everything must go. Andy, everyone loves an auction, from the fast-talking auctioneer to the person who mistakenly bids £13 million on a bicycle by sneezing. They are undeniably good fun. And with the global situation the way it is, you can find some real global bargains around at the moment. There have been some great auctions all over the world in the last week that have met with mixed results. So get your numbered paddles out, make sure you got some throat tweets in your pocket so you don't cough your way into owning a Van Gogh, and let's get this auction of stories started. First item up, Greece news! Andy, we touched on this a couple of weeks ago, but Greece has been forced to put up €50 billion of their prized national assets on sale. And those €50 billion might end up being virtually worthless if Greece ends up inadvertently detonating the single currency. Now, apparently, the auction was held last week in London, in a hotel ballroom. Tough place to hold an auction for the Greeks. London, Andy. They're not going to get any bids from the British. Just a promise that we'll take it all off their hands for them free of charge and look after their country's finest treasures for them. We'll give them a happy home. Just leave them next to your marbles, Greece, and you can visit them whenever you like during museum hours. We'll even give you a 2-for-1 coupon, not valid weekends.
It'll be interesting to see if in 2,000 years' time people are trekking round the British Museum looking at Athens Airport circa 2010.
That's the point. Up for sale were 39 airports, 850 ports, railways, motorways, sewage works, a couple of energy companies, banks, defence groups, thousands of acres of land for potential development, casinos, and Greece's national lottery. But apparently the assembled private equity bosses who had gathered there for the, and I quote, parade of Greece's national treasures, showed little interest in buying anything. That is so sad, Andy. Greece has now basically become a low-range stripper, crawling around in front of businessmen, offering cut-price lap dances and getting absolutely no takers. That is humiliating.
Yeah, let's take a closer look at some of the things that were on offer. Airports, 39 airports, and as far as I'm aware, John, I think they might be making some of those airports up. But I would have bid, but I've got enough clutter in my house without having Thessaloniki Airport rammed into the corner of my living room with a load of pissed up British holiday makers traipsing through it. Motorways, as you said, they'd be nice to have. Sewage works, no thank you. No thank you, John. I like tzatziki, but in moderation and not pre-eaten. Also, banks, the national lottery, and the overwhelming sense of a nation that peaked almost 2,500 years ago. And the only thing that was actually sold was the singer Nana Mouskouri, who was bought by Donald Trump for £450 to function as part of a musical toilet flush. I mean, it's sad days, sad days.
But it's naive salesmanship from the Greeks. They know that their country does not represent an attractive place to invest at the moment, so you have to make the items more appealing. While you're showing slides of your sewage works, why not pump the smell of fresh-baked bread into the hotel ballroom? When you're selling a house, apparently the kitchen and the bathroom are a big selling point, so they really need to make sure that when they're selling their motorways, there's a power shower in the middle of every road every 5 miles or so, or a microwave and a dishwasher in every bank. You have to use the tricks of the trade.
Greece's Special Secretary for Asset Restructuring and Privatisations. What a lovely job title that is. A man called George Christodoulakis. He said the sell-off would raise $50 billion and help pay back the country's $110 billion bailout debt. And he was interrupted when he was saying this by someone saying that the sell-off was, quote, destroying our country. And he said, there's no point crying over spilt milk, and told his fellow countrymen to be optimistic. So there you go. No, you
still a bit of the Greek stiff upper lip there.
That's quite a lot of milk that's been spilt. $110 billion worth. Billion euros worth of milk. Well, that is probably enough milk to drown the whole of Persia. And in fact, I believe what Alexander the Great was intending to do, had he had the milk resources.
Yeah, it's definitely enough milk to be worth getting a little bit weepy over. But last bugle, we talked about the Greek economy, or more specifically, the gaping hole in the ground where its economy used to be. And they managed to pass the austerity measures bill they needed, which promises to make the entire country unbelievably miserable for the next decade, and looks odds on to keep that promise 150%. It's a terrible situation for the Greek people, but the more details you find out about life over there over the last 20 years or so, the harder it is not to get angry with them. One of the problems I found out after the last bugle was that the Greek people could retire at 53 years old. 53! Are you f***ing kidding me, Greece? I don't want to be judgmental, but that's simply not working hard enough or long enough. And what's interesting is that in America, there is traditionally a much different view on the standard Greek work ethic, because Greek Americans became famous for opening diners over here and running them with a phenomenal work ethic. Restaurants that are open 24/7, 365, with menus larger than a Russian novel, affording you the opportunity to order goji berry pancakes or stuffed crab at 4 in the morning. You would ask your Greek waiter if that was really possible. And that's why this doesn't make sense. Greece has somehow become a country where you can retire at 53. After a working life, sitting around on a scooter all day and sexually assaulting tourists. This is Greece, Andy. This is Greece. They used to stage enormous orgies. They don't just happen, you know. That takes a great deal of planning and imagination. So don't tell me that Greece can't somehow create a system now where they pay some taxes, work a full week, and take less than 2.5 months of paid vacation per year. I'm not saying don't have orgies, Greece. I'm just saying that's what weekends are for. Wait for Saturday, that way you'll feel like you've earned them.
I guess as a nation, they thought, well, we've invented democracy, We've pioneered most known art forms, and we've laid the foundations for Western civilization. And we've done all this whilst having absolutely cracking six-packs and an enlightened attitude towards what you can stick your willy in. So it's kind of understandable. I then thought, let's just kick back. Let's take it easy for the foreseeable.
But I'm sure, Andy, that even Dionysus woke up every now and then on a Monday morning with a massive hangover and said, "Hey, guys, can you get the f*** out of my bed, please? I have to go to work." Then he took off his toga, put on a pale blue bun-down shirt and tie, and worked a 40-hour week like a normal person. Is that so f***ing hard, Greece? Next item on the list today, a real collector's item, this Margaret Thatcher's handbag. Andy, a black leather handbag held by Margaret Thatcher in a photo where she walked alongside Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, fetched £25,000 in a charity auction. And I guess the big question is, who would spend that kind of money on a handbag owned by Margaret Thatcher? And of course the answer is, a psychopath. A psychopath would spend that money. And I actually started to wonder whether this was, in fact, a charity auction at all, or whether it's one of those police honey traps, like where they lure prisoners out of hiding by posing as an organisation that tells them they're just one of these speedboats. What am I bid for Margaret Thatcher's handbag? £25,000? Thank you, sir. Arrest that man, officer. Arrest him immediately. At the auction at Christie's headquarters in central London, as it concluded, Lord Archer, who was handling the auction, said, "The handbag makes you automatically think of Margaret Thatcher." Why is that, Lord Archer? Is that because the handbag is dark, surprisingly durable, and has literally no heart inside it? Boom! Take that, frail old lady, decades past her relevance. Boom! Next lot's coming up, celebrity shit. And there were some big sales of celebrity memorabilia this week, showing that the global recession is not bad enough yet to affect rich people buying stuff to put on their walls to provoke conversations during interminable dinner parties. And Michael Jackson's red leather jacket from the Thriller video has sold at auction in California for $1.8 million. It was bought by a Texas commodities trader who said he plans to use it to raise money for children's charities. Really? Children's charities. Michael Jackson's jacket. Did none of his friends want to point out a potential conflict of interest there? Could he not have bought, I don't know, Madonna's corset or Prince's guitar or basically any item from anyone who was not famously charged with child sex offences?
Come on, it wasn't Michael Jackson's underpants, John. It was just the jacket.
True.
When I heard that the Thriller jacket had sold for $1.8 million, I just assumed people meant it was the waistcoat that Dennis Taylor wore during the 1985 World Snooker Championship final. But turned out it was actually Jackson's jacket. Some proceeds from the sale are going to the Animal Sanctuary, where Michael Jackson's two Bengal tigers, Thriller and Sabu, now reside. It's not surprising, I guess, that Michael Jackson had two Bengal tigers. In fact, it's kind of more surprising that he didn't have more than two Bengal tigers. But apparently when they were first delivered, Jackson rang up the mail order company and said, "Hey, yeah, it's Michael Jackson here. My delivery's just arrived. Yep, I think my carpets are a bit undercooked. They're very wriggly. Very unusually wriggly for a carpet." Arguably, also, John, it's too much for a jacket. $1.8 million. For that price, John, I would want Michael Jackson still in it. At the very... I don't mind if he's dead or alive. At very least, I want General Sir Michael Jackson, the former head of the British Armed Forces, who ironically actually invented the moonwalk as a military tactic to be viewed from front on to make opposing forces think you were still advancing when in fact you were running away. And also, a £25 million painting by Egon Schiele sold this week. Now, if you bought a painting for £25 million, John, and I know...
Yeah.
You probably have. But probably you've got to decorate your new flat with something, haven't you? You're going to want to spend every minute of every day sitting in front of it looking at it. You want to get your money's worth out of that. It's going to be tough for you socially. "Hey, Joey, you fancy coming to see the ball game? It's Yankees against the Sox in Game 7 of the World Series." No thanks, Beatrice. I'm just going to sit at home and look at my painting. Even if I live until I'm 105, it's still costing me 40 quid a f***ing minute.
Yeah, it was... I've seen the painting in question, Andy, and it's a cityscape. And it's a lot of money to pay for a cityscape that doesn't have a single penis painted on any of the rooms. I guess there's just no accounting for taste. You can only imagine how much it would have sold for if there was just one penis on one of the roofs. In fact, I think they should auction off the roof that had the penis painted on it as a piece of art in itself. Next up, we have a major item for collectors. It's a painting titled Penis on Roof from a young British wunderkind. It's a 60-foot painting on tile. Some slight damage following a heavy storm and birds nesting on the corner of it. Still a magnificent piece. A great companion to the artist's earlier work, Penis on Desk. I'll start the bidding at £6 million. Who'll give me £6 million? £6 million in the corner. Who'll give me £7 million in the front here? Who'll give me £30 million? £30 million at the back there. It will be a bargain, Andy.
If you want more on the penis on the roof, Bugle number 69, I believe, was the historic issue in which we discussed this highly significant artistic event in more detail than two grown men probably should have done.
Final auction item now, all your own stuff. Andy, there is a store in Texas which is selling all the things that get confiscated by airport security agents. In 2010, Texas's whole state general fund made $300,000 from the store's sales. So one of the most common items in there is apparently snow globes. They have, and I believe the exact number is, a load of snow globes in this store. And the problem is that snow globes are filled with liquid, so are now prohibited from being carried onto a plane. And the amount of snow globes confiscated seems to suggest, firstly, that everyone keeps forgetting that you're not allowed to bring them onto a plane. And secondly, the snow globes are a hell of a lot more popular than you think they are. The most common item of all is knives, which statistically seems to suggest that people are carrying a weapon just in case someone tries to steal their f***ing snow globe. There are also a lot of belt buckles, apparently, that were confiscated, a number of them in the shape of a gun, which you can understand might freak security out, and one belt buckle in the shape of a life-size hand grenade. And you know what, Andy? If you try going through security with a hand grenade belt buckle, you deserve whatever rubber glove-based search is about to be inflicted upon your person.
And now, buglers, the literary phenomenon of the year, the planet's biggest selling novel of the 21st century, the book already being described as the one Charles Dickens couldn't have even dreamt of writing. Sorry, I missed that. I misread that. Wouldn't have even dreamt of writing. The tone John Grisham himself disclaimed was, "My greatest work, the confluence of all I've tried to achieve with a pen and a bit of paper. It's part three of the Congressman's Penis." I know you've all been waiting for this, quite literally, on tenterhooks. Some of you even went out and bought some tenterhooks just to hang yourselves on. Last time, Mickey Stantanio, PI, searched for the missing penis, and the congressman from whom it originated took him to Washington, D.C., in the company of the sultry Bridget. The two hatched a plan to break into Congress and start a widespread wangspection to find out whose penis it was. Chapter 3. Mickey Stantanio stood in the vestibule of the Congress building, dressed in his athletics kit. "And that, ladies and gentlemen," he announced to the watching company, "is how you do the triple jump." The congressmen and congresswomen nodded their political heads, uttered platitudes to each other about taking the hop phase on board and moving forward to a more holistic approach to triple jumping, and scattered toward some new research sandpits. "Phew," extrapolated Mickey. "Talking my way into Congress by claiming I had to do a presentation on triple jumping was high risk, but it worked, and I managed to set a new U.S. indoor triple jump record in the process, breaking Mike Conley's long-standing and extremely patriotic distance of 17 meters 76. I just hope they don't make me take a piss test. I've been eating nothing but kangaroo steaks for months to make myself boingier." Stantanio knew this was his chance to get into the Congress shower block and check out some groins. "I've got to get in there. By the sounds of it, Bridget has been pretty successful in disguising herself as the Congress Speaker and making inflammatory remarks during her debate about the legalization of women, causing a mass wrestle on the Congress floor. They're all going to need to freshen up in the showers after that." Stantanio put on his lab coat, picked up his clipboard, and claimed to be a Nobel Prize-winning scientific research assistant from the International Institute of Wangology, started questioning the congressman as they filed into shower. "Congressman Lambridio, I'm Stantanio from the IIW. Have you got a penis?" "Sure I have, Mickey. It's right here in my wallet." "Okay," nodded Mickey academically.
Now you, Congressman Platch, have you got a penis? I sure do. Do you need it now? It's just I left it in the glove compartment of my car this morning. I didn't think I'd need it today. Okay, no problem, Congressman, said Mickey, scratching himself at the implication. It seems, he said internally, that all congressmen have removable penises. That penis that's on the loose somewhere in the USA could be anyone's. Just then, Congressman Pal Crutchett strode in his wrestling kit. Congressman, it's Mickey Stantino, IIW. You got a penis?
Yeah, I got one of those. I keep it in a safety deposit box on my ranch. Do you want the code?
Wouldn't that defeat the object of keeping it in a safety deposit box, said Mickey.
Good point. Anyway, it's 354175.
Man, no wonder it keeps going missing.
Did you say it keeps going missing, said Mickey?
Sure it does, says Paul Crutchett.
Congressman, said Mickey, when did you last see your penis?
I'm not sure. Let me think. I took it out for dinner on our anniversary.
Well, that's my birthday. It's the same thing, really.
Since then, I don't know, I'd say 2 weeks. 2 weeks at least.
Congressman, said Mickey, have you got any enemies? For example, anyone who might want to take your penis hostage?
Congressman Paul Crutchett gulped. I knew this day would come. For me, and for my penis. Sit down, Stantino. We gotta talk. To be continued.
To be continued? How is this not over? To be continued? I was starting this with the final installment, Andy.
Well, yeah, people have got to give the public what they demand, John. You know, and when the story's developing in its own arc, John, I can't interrupt that arc. You know, I've got to let it evolve. That's what Dostoevsky used to do with his stories about penises.
Your emails now, and well, to prove, John, that three parts would have been by no means enough to do full justice to Grisham's debut novel, this came in from Tori in New York City, who writes, Dear Andy, John and Chris, in the order of likelihood to choose Paradise by the Dashboard Light as their karaoke song. Tori writes, For reasons I'm currently struggling to recall, I found myself browsing the Wikipedia entry for John Grisham this afternoon. I learnt many interesting facts about the esteemed Mr. Grisham, including his belief that his early career as a plant waterer at a local nursery had, quote, no future. A bold statement, Mr. Grisham. I also learnt that Wikipedia states, as a fact, as gospel truth, that John Grisham is the author of The Congressman and that he is a personal fan of the Bugle.
Wikipedia is so flawed, actually.
The citation for this...
is so flawed.
Let me illustrate how flawed. The citation for this, Tori writes, is that episode of The Bugle itself, which seems to me creates some sort of comedy citation paradox. Regardless, congratulations on your celebrity listener. A screenshot attached for posterity, because something this beautiful on Wikipedia is sure not to last long. Although it's been there since the 12th, meaning I'm likely the first person in a week who's found some burning need to know everything there is about John Grisham. Best Tory in New York City. So there you go. Interestingly as well, whoever put it up was sensible enough to call it The Congressman, not The Congressman's Penis. Clearly it's a US title for a more sensitive US market, and also, I guess, to escape detection for longer.
It's phenomenal, Andy. First we were on the barracks, looking for your page. Now the congressman's penis is immortalised in John Grisham's canon of work. Sensational work.
So, do keep your emails coming into the Bugle at timesonline.co.uk. And we're going to wrap it up there for this week because, well, sonically, this has not been the greatest Bugle of all time. John's
not the strongest.
John's phone line.
Even worse than when you were in India.
Yeah.
So, I'll be back in the studio next week. So, you know, you'll be able to hear me without kind of hissing, or I don't know if you've been hearing any of the traffic outside in the street.
All right. Just heard you being nagged by your future wife. So, thanks for listening, Buglers. We'll be back with Bugle 160 next week. Goodbye.